You are listening to a Wyatt Phosphorus Pictures podcast.
Broadcasting under the night sky from the edge of an undisclosed jungle on the Gulf of Mexico, I'm Christopher Garitano, your voice in the night. For the next hour, allow me to be your guide into the bizarre unknown, the fantastic macabre, and together we'll journey to that borderland between fiction and reality, a place beyond all rational explanation. We are now off to the witch. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another Off to the Witch newsletter. For those of you just tuning into Off to the Witch, the newsletter episodes are an alternate week version of the podcast. Usually the podcast has a guest and a theme, and it's a little more stylized and structured than this newsletter. But the newsletter allows me to tell you a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes with Off to the Witch and White Phosphorus Pictures, as well as an opportunity for me to lend my personal voice. Because the regular episodes, I like to focus on the guest and really learn as much as I can about the guest. So I try not to interject with my own opinions too much. So I've been working on several projects right now. One enormous project for television with several movies involved. And another is my independently produced documentaries that I've been working on for a little while. So to talk about the independent documentaries first, A Haunting We Will Go is volume one in my new series. I've made several programs for television as a producer, director, and host. And with a project of that size, always comes with an enormous amount of collaboration, which I enjoy, but also compromise too, because there's these people when you're working in television that you never meet. And they have a say in what happens at the end of the day. So I am the kind of artist and filmmaker that believes in your own individual expression. I'm certainly a team player, but I like to choose the team, if you know what I mean. I like working with people, but I think it's a detriment to a project if you don't have a visionary at the helm, because it becomes homogenized and then you're just serving either an algorithm or a demographic, and that is not me. And so my television programs, as much as I pushed for what I wanted, as much as I pushed for quality, and there is quality in them, especially in comparison to a lot of the dreck that's being made over and over and over again, that they weren't 100% of my vision. So the reason why I chose to make my independent documentaries, which is this investigative series, is because I have 100% control creatively. And, you know, the only drawback to that is you're not initially given the same amount of money. However, you know, after 24 years, this is post-film school, I've acquired a considerable amount of skill as a movie maker. You do. And I think projects that are typical, that end up just like what you see on TV or brand X versions of what you keep seeing over and over again, miss the mark because they didn't learn their craft. And that's why they're typical, because there is this kind of boilerplate scheme of, you know, it, especially in the world of the paranormal or an investigative series, is that you simply have a very light version of what I feel the audience deserves. And at the end of the day, it's as far as your imagination can go. So a documentary like A Haunting We Will Go takes time to make, even if it was being financed by a network. Money, you can throw money at a camera all day. You can get the greatest, most expensive camera in the world. It won't make a fantastic movie for you. It's not going to do that. And it comes from your intellect, your experience, your heart, your skill, and your passion as a movie maker. And so I would never tackle a subject, whether it be with a network or independently, without all of the above, without all of the above moving me. And so I care so much about this new series. It's important that I made something better than my last show for network TV, which was Strange World. And you will start to see these episodes come out this year. I have two right now that are in post-production, one of which is A Haunting We Will Go. And again, my shorthand, I've explained this before, for this little adventure is the ultimate Halloween special. Now, I guess for some people that might be shortchanging it a bit. My promise is that it's unlike anything you've ever seen before. And when you're creating something like that, you have no model to base it off of. It's pure. It doesn't resemble anything else. I mean, there might be aesthetic, classic aesthetics about it because I love that stuff. So you're gonna feel nostalgic, especially because during your formative years, you are now absorbing, and it doesn't matter. It could be new generations. All these new generations, including past generations, have absorbed, you know, 30, 40, 50 years worth of Halloween culture, ghost stories, and horror films. And so that's really what fueled this chapter. You know, I have forthcoming chapters that each have their own inspirations. But I'm considering the audience in all of this. I'm considering you because I'm one of you, and I will not celebrate something that's typical. My interest, just like yours, in the paranormal, in mysteries of the world, in fiction, in horror films, all of the above, came long before this series of homogenized television shows and talking heads at conventions. And so if you have nothing fresh to offer on a mysterious subject, I have no interest. I can't celebrate you. I can't celebrate what you're doing. It's not interesting to me. And I wouldn't be making this podcast. I wouldn't be creating movies. I wouldn't be writing if I wasn't interested in it. I think there are fantastic opportunities these days more than ever in terms of venue and production for filmmakers, for people that want to express their perspective through that art form. But there's also free education out there too, and that takes time. I think if anybody out there really wants to call themselves a movie maker, it's not just because you rolled some footage and slapped it together and put it out. That's not a movie. If you want to call yourself a movie maker, you know, apply yourself. And I encourage that. I love it when somebody starts burning to make films, but respect it just like anything else. If you call yourself a musician, brain surgeon, astrophysicist, writer, come on, everything's at your disposal now in terms of education. You know, they have master classes out there where Spike Lee, Martin Scorsese, Ron Howard, David Lynch, Werner Herzog are all teaching courses. I mean, you can't beat that. We had people like that, like Oliver Stone gave a lecture at my film school. I went to a fantastic film school. In my opinion, I went 4 full-time years. Of course, all of those courses weren't, you know, there's this misconception that film school is like you run around with a camera all day. Well, we learned how to shoot. We learned what lenses do. We learned the mathematics of lighting equations. We learned how to write. You know, there were tons of writing courses. There were acting courses, directing courses, theater courses. You know, any spectrum of education in regard to how to make a motion picture was all available to you. And we learned on film at the time, you know, actual celluloid 16 millimeter film. And I'm grateful for that because you have limited choices, whereas now you have infinite choices. And I think new people who touch that medium, it's so convenient for them that they don't respect it. And that's why their movies and their documentaries are really bad. I think William Friedkin, the great filmmaker who directed The French Connection, The Exorcist, Sorcerer, he said that it's time that will judge how great your movie is. you know, if you have a flock of people, of yes men, that tell you how great you are during the zeitgeist of the time your movie comes out, that's not healthy. What's going to happen is the test of time is going to tell. You can have your detractors. Every single movie does, from the greatest to the worst. And you can have a million supporters when your movie comes out, and it could win Best Picture at those garbage Oscars. But the test of time is what matters. And some of my favorite movies that include Blade Runner, Sorcerer, John Carpenter's The Thing, those movies were slammed when they came out. Even Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, it's so weird how many people try to slam that film, and it's like, okay, you have every right to have your opinion, but that movie is fantastic, and there is no version of The Shining that even compares, I'm sorry to tell you. So it's the test of time. People will be watching Stanley Kubrick's The Shining in droves in 100 years from now because it's that powerful. And, you know, other attempts at trying to adapt that novel into a movie that have already been made at this time, I don't think many people will be watching. And that's just the way it goes. You know, time is the greatest truth teller, and time unravels all lies and dissipates them. But one truth, and this is the subject of tonight, is violence. We were designed with violence. And if you were to look back in any biblical tomes, there are stories of great violence. Historical record shows stories of an intense brutality, unlike anybody, I would say right now, could understand, or most people. I can't say anyone, because right now we're going through another era of great change and turmoil. And one of the projects I'm working on right now for television is that I am writing and producing a movie that I haven't mentioned by name yet, about a protest of violence by making a piece of artwork that is so violent you can't look away. And that was the intent behind this particular situation. And it's so interesting to me, and it always has been, because you have a variety of personalities that one way or another celebrate violence. It's part of our nature. And there's this odd duality, because some of the most intelligent, gentle, thoughtful people celebrate violence. Let me tell you what I'm talking about here, is that I've met a lot of people that love horror films along the way, that celebrate sports like mixed martial arts or boxing or even football. It's all violence, you know. The previously mentioned sports are the modern day gladiators. It's something that everybody flocked to see. And in that case, going back to ancient Rome, there was a slaughter before your eyes that people cheered for. And now I wonder if, because of the evolution of society and the eradication of things like that, that even though deep in our nature, we still have that innate desire to celebrate violence. It's something that we hide. You know, when we go see the latest sequel of Halloween and we watch the character Michael Myers slaughter another group of teenagers, we cheer, at each kill. There's some horror fans out there that revel in the idea of quote-unquote kills. But I think these people in real life would be terrified if they were faced with murder, if they were faced with their own death, looking the Grim Reaper directly into the eyes and knowing that they're about to be murdered. That's a whole different thing. And so it's odd to me that that we celebrate that. And there have been provocateurs, people that challenge the audience in the world of violent cinema. Because in one case, we'll celebrate, you know, the Lethal Weapon pictures or a Western by Sergio Leone, which I love those movies, all of them, you know, for their style, their action, their cinema. Then you have someone like Sam Peckinpah, who challenged your mind with the movie Straw Dogs and forced you to see violence. You know, the movie was subversive because it challenged you to understand the duality of people, how far they would be pushed, mistakes could be made, things are taken too far, and then violence erupts. This happens every day. And very few movie makers have exposed you to something that was close to real violence. And I celebrate those filmmakers too, because, you know, a few, one Sam Peckinpah, another was Wes Craven with his very first, you know, motion picture, Last House on the Left. Another was Jim Van Beber later on. And, you know, for whatever misconception that some of his audience may have about Jim, he understood how horrible violence is, and he didn't want to pull any punches showing you that in his movies. And so even though moments are stylized in Jim's work, he still shows you how horrible violence truly is, how our brutality exists. And I don't think Jim would ever make something like what Wes did later on, even though Wes Craven had made so many thoughtful commentaries in his more stylized pictures, probably because he made such a statement with Last House on the Left that he didn't need to repeat it again. Stanley Kubrick in A Clockwork Orange had so much to say about violence, and it was such an over-stylized movie, such a brilliant movie, but over-stylized in such a way that it was being celebrated and that it encouraged violence instead of turning people off. And cinema can stop things from happening. A lot of people don't realize how close we were in the early 80s to nuclear destruction. And there was a movie, a television movie with Jason Robards and a whole cast of characters, John Lithgow, called The Day After in the early 80s. And so President Reagan was shown that movie by Nicholas Meyer and, you know, the filmmaker. It was brought to the White House. It was brought to Congress. And that movie single-handedly changed the perspective of launching nukes, because I believe that the Cold War was at its most feverish pitch, and we were about to destroy each other, Russia and the United States. And a movie, a motion picture, changed, or I would say opened the mind of the United States government, and I believe it was also shown to the USSR at the time. A motion picture can change and move the world. It can open minds and change people. And so I think this is why violence in cinema is so important for reflection. We're going through a time right now where I think there's an insensitivity to violence. And, you know, I've been surrounded by violent pictures my entire life. I grew up in a video store. I worked at a couple of movie theaters, and then another video store when I lived in New York City, two different ones. And so I was immersed in cinema my entire life. But I also lived. I played sports. I was out on the streets all the time. I was outside. You know, this was a time where kids weren't shoved in a corner with an iPad, you know, playing some video game all the time. We did things and we experienced life. We got injured, you know, like not the kids don't today, but I think there's an insensitivity to violence and culture removing that thoughtfulness and that intelligence to such an extreme where now it's just another video game to see people get murdered does something to the brain. And so movies like what Sam Peckinpah was making with Straw Dogs, or what Jim Van Beber did with several of his movies, or Wes Craven did with Last House on the Left. And there are a lot of filmmakers of modern times. You know, I saw a French picture by a filmmaker named Pascal Laugier called Martyrs. There was an American remake of it, but the original film was powerful. And oddly enough, it dealt with some conspiratorial ideas that there was this underground society of people who were capturing kids and using them for these experiments. The experiment wasn't necessarily a mind control experiment. It was more to achieve some kind of state of consciousness, an almost afterlife hypnosis. And the movie was brutally violent, but still stylized. And I wonder, you know, most humans faced with real violence, most humans faced with the true honesty, the vicious, heartless nature of violence, would never want to go near it again. And so I think a lot of people who make violent pictures, I can't say all of them, are anti-violent human beings. They, maybe it's not so black and white. I think that a lot of them think about violence. You know, in Sam Peckinpah's case, when he made the motion picture Straw Dogs, the character played by Dustin Hoffman was a mathematician and a pacifist. And he leaves the United States because of all of the violence of the late 60s. And they end up settling in a small Cornish village in the UK. That's his wife's hometown. And it's expected to be possibly the most secure, docile place they could be. They're looking forward to spending their time in this sleepy atmosphere in this very small town in England. And that's a fallacy, because you could be anywhere, anytime, and violence can erupt for reasons unknown, or just human nature, jealousy, people coveting each other, anger, you know, who knows what motivates a human being to do what they do. So I've always appreciated, you know, while I'm immersed in this project, writing this right now, this movie, I've always appreciated how subversive truly violent motion pictures can be if they're made by a thoughtful person. If they're made for shock value, that's a different thing. You know, the great Herschel Gordon Lewis was an exploitation horror movie director, and he made a movie that predated Last House on the Left, and it was called Blood Feast. And, you know, it was just this over-the-top kind of riff on EC Comics, those you know, Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror, blood and gore, because that wasn't anything new. If you backtrack some episodes ago of Off to the Witch, I did an episode on the Grand Guignol, which is a French theater revival now in Italy, and I interviewed the head of that theater troupe that's reviving it in Rome currently. However, way back in France, it just showed not a bloodlust, but the same interest that we have in violent cinema was done on the stage. And there was a rendition of this, for those of you that remember the motion picture Interview with a Vampire. That vampire theater was a riff on that old French gore theater, that violence on stage. And if we look at Shakespeare, you know, everything from Macbeth to Titus Andronicus being one of the most violent Shakespeare stories, where, much like in Last House on the Left, there's a woman that's dragged into the woods, dismembered, her tongue is cut out, hands are cut off. And this was William Shakespeare. So there has been this provocative violence in motion pictures, in music. You know, a lot of the gangster rap from the 90s, in a way, even though unfortunately it backfired, I think, on some of these people, is that they were using that same method of portraying violence in story and image, but it encouraged people, much like A Clockwork Orange did, may have encouraged some people to violence because it was attractive, because it had style to it. Some heavy metal or punk or hardcore music, you know, really gets people going, want to fight, want to hurt people, to encourage violence because there's a rage and an explosion of it. There's music that inspired wars. And I wonder, you know, whereas some music soothes and motion pictures enlighten, artwork inspires a devilish nature, and then others have the reverse effect. And the interesting thing is, I think there are very few people, when violence is actually portrayed correctly, and it was in the motion picture Last House on the Left, that it's supposed to turn your stomach, that it must turn you away from this, and that you're forced, that you can't ignore it. Whereas in the world right now, that is many people's reality happening right at this moment. And it is here in the US, it is all over the world, that there are people being forced to not look away. Perhaps we need that, because amongst all of the people that are so capable of this violence, there are many people that are incapable of it, that won't turn to it, and they've shown that throughout history.
There are those who say that this quiet town holds many secrets. Legend has it that beneath this very tower, a dark force had its eyes set on the children.
We were told that what was going on there was for the benefit of humanity.
What would you say to the people who say, well, all these children were kidnapped and murdered, and you were a part of it? What would you tell them?
I did approve of it, but there was nothing I could do about it.
They wanted a large number of programmed boys to be used for mind control operations.
And there are others who say it's still happening to this day.
I don't know, I for myself find it a little suspicious that all the evidence has been conveniently destroyed.
Let's put it this way. If you're sitting there with 20 guns pointed at you, what are you going to do? Whatever the hell they want!
Watch Montauk Chronicles now for free on Tubi, Plex, Roku, and available for download on Amazon and Apple TV.
This series presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones, to the mysteries we will examine.
I don't know if being completely nonviolent is a detriment or not. I think in some cases it might be. And I think, you know, part of the story of Last House on the Left, which also can date back to an Ingmar Bergman picture, The Virgin Spring, which is the same story, is that it's not just a story about violence and destruction of innocence, but it's also a story of revenge. By people who normally wouldn't do something like this, they're brought to this state of brutal revenge, where now they are the committer of violence, where they may have been a pacifist before and coming full circle with Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. That is what his part of his statement was. There were many in that movie, but part of that statement was, how far could you drive a pacifist, who is Dustin Hoffman's character, to become a violent killer, which he does by the end of the movie? It's just so fascinating. I wanted to discuss this a little bit tonight. It's been the topic of conversation on the show a few times, and if you backtrack to the episode with Jim Van Bibber, you can hear us talk about these things in regard to his own cinema and other great filmmakers throughout cinema history. The way I think it's portrayed in video games, as far as my knowledge goes on these long play video games, I know the game Grand Theft Auto, a lot of kids love to participate, a lot of the war games, and I've played them too, and they're interesting. I mean, I grew up playing with war toys. So that was part of our programming as young kids in the 80s. If you had tanks, guns, knives, you had soldiers offing each other in record numbers, and you're essentially making your own violent movie because you're holding these idols and you're imagining what it's really like. There's some kind of desire in us to participate in these things. I've eternally tried to explore that, but then there's the other extreme where most of us would never want to see an animal get hurt. Most of us would never want to see another human being get hurt or brutally maim or kill another human being. And but it's there, and people can be driven to that. This is an important time in history right now. I think we need another wake-up call in cinema and music. And it's not just simply to preach peace. You know, there was a great line from the Black Sabbath tune Under the Sun, I believe. And, you know, Ozzy said, I don't believe in your violence, and I don't even believe in your peace. And sometimes that's the way I feel, because I have an open mind to our existence. And I can't say that if faced with the destruction of my own life or one of my loved ones, that I wouldn't bring great violence upon another person. I probably would. But I don't fantasize about those things, nor do I want to hurt anybody. So that's an odd thing that we're wrestling with. And we can take it to another level and really consider, well, where do we come from? It seems like we have all these conflicting consciousness inside ourselves. We have the rage of the primate, you know, within us, and the animal. I mean, we have fangs, you know, we have incisors, we have... There's a lot of proof that of our animal nature, because it's in us. And as much as we like to turn our fluffy little animals in the jungle and the forest into cartoons, the jungle and the forest are extremely violent and painful. You know, I feel for the creatures outside, because a lot of us turn a blind eye to what's going on in the animal kingdom. It's extremely violent. It is more violent than the human kingdom. And we have risen above that. So, you know, and I've heard one time from somebody who was bold enough to say it, is that we have both animal and alien in us. And the alien nature is what keeps us from being violent. I disagree with that. If there is some kind of extraterrestrial DNA in us as well, I don't think it's that that's keeping us, some of us, considering being nonviolent. I think it's the combination. I think it's a unique combination. I think human beings are strange creatures. And, you know, to a good deal of the animal kingdom, we are a threat. We are the aliens. We capture things from the jungle and we experiment on them. We do horrible things And we turn a blind eye. You know, there are most people that go out and order a steak dinner that would never, I mean, you know, if you were in the presence of a steer, you'd pet it and you'd feel for it. You wouldn't hurt it. You couldn't possibly. But, you know, you go to the restaurant and eat one. And in the case of, you know, anybody that is in touch with nature, there have been hunters that I've had conversations with that have hunted most of their life, and then just out of the blue one day after they took the life of either a deer or anything else they were hunting, any other kind of game, is that they broke down and cried out of the blue. Such an interesting thing to me. And again, I'm not criticizing any of that. I'm just an observer. Like I'm learning about us. And that's what most of this is about. You know, it's my caution, even with paranormal stories, is that I'm in the process of learning for a very long time. So I cannot declare the truth. I can tell you what the experience was. I can't tell you what it was. And I think it helps us to understand this process of evolution, hopefully, that we're going through. Because the violence of the past in history, the violence of our past history, is infinitely more brutal and unforgiving than now. Think of everything from the Crusades to the Inquisitions to the witch trials to, you know, these horrible moments of just heartlessness and brutality, and in some cases in the name of religion. What religion allows you to slaughter and dismember human beings? I think you should re-examine your faith. I believe sometimes when we hit a place of evolution and a place of enlightenment, because there are societies of people who are very anti-violent in terms of senseless violence, most of us wouldn't commit it. But you can be walking down the street and have someone take your life for a pocket full of cash. I mean, it might not even be that much, and it's happened more than you'd like to know. I mean, there was a young lady in New York City last year. This is one of probably thousands and thousands of examples I could give right now. But she walked out of a library, she's a college student, and these 14-year-old kids stabbed her to death because she didn't give up her pocketbook. I mean, they stabbed a woman to death, a young woman. There's no heart. There's no value to human life whatsoever. How did that happen? What is the consciousness of these kids doing this? You can't just say they were under the influence. You know, I grew up with a story and they blamed it on this gentleman, Ricky Casso, being under the influence. And then he ended up stabbing his friend. This was in my hometown as a kid, stabbing his friend, carving out his eyes. Some people said it was over a bad drug deal. It wasn't. There was something else going on. We have some other nature. There's a dark side to the human being. And some of us have been able to either contain it and keep it at bay, or in some cases, I believe I've met some people that are so enlightened that I think they've eradicated that dark side. I think they turned their back on it. And then others use it to protect people who feel that everyone should be serene and peaceful and never lift a violent hand to anyone. Well, unfortunately, we share this earth with extreme violence in the shadows. And stories like the one that inspired Last House on the Left, and these things happen every day. You know, even recently, you know, in the news, they were talking about a young lady that was murdered while she was jogging on campus. That is a Last House on the Left type story. These things happen more than you'd like to know. You know, learning about certain serial killers and things they've done. I don't even know how you could possibly animate or celebrate these people, but we tend to do that. We stylize these things. We turn them into movie franchises. And once again, the people that celebrate them, that wear the t-shirts, and I have horror movie memorabilia around my office right now where I'm recording this show. And I had an interesting gentleman I met some years ago that said to me, why is it that we like these movies so much? And so from then on, I really thought about it. It wasn't self-punishment. It's just self-examination. I want to learn about us. I want to learn about the human being, how we tick, what makes us think, why do we love all of these aesthetics? Because ultimately what I'm getting at is there really is a hidden history. It's slowly unfolding. We do live in extraordinary times. Unfortunately, with that comes a lot of turmoil and chaos that some of us might randomly have to face. I've been seeing a lot of odd behavior lately. And let me say very clearly that I believe this world ultimately is beautiful, but I don't think it's beautiful if I just turn a blind eye to all of the darkness in the world. I think it's beautiful for that too, because it's an interesting place to be. Would I like to see all the pain and horror stop? Yeah, I would, but I wonder what that world would be like. And unfortunately, it's against our nature. You can't tell the snake to stop eating rats. You can't tell the tiger to not kill its prey. And there are people out there that have that violent, predatory nature about them. And I think in cases of war or other professions, they might try and placate that situation or pacify it, that desire. And others are wired to kill. So turning a blind eye to it and just to say, well, the world is the way I see it, is naive. It's not the way you see it. That means you're ignoring what's happening down the street. The world is still happening down the street, unbeknownst to you. You're just ignoring it. It doesn't disappear because you turn a blind eye to it and everything is butterflies and flowers and, you know, Snow White. The world is a dark place, and it's a beautiful place all at once. And for us to fully understand, I think it's important for us to also face the darkness. To not revel in the abyss, because then, like Nietzsche said, it's going to swallow you, you know, if you look too deep into it. It doesn't mean turn a blind eye to the horrors of the world, because the only way we're going to eradicate it or evolve is to face it, is to understand it. So naivete is not the solution, in my opinion. And, you know, this has been an ongoing thing because there was a good deal of us are fans of violent art or sport or anything that involves violence. You'll shock yourself if you really sit and take your time and think about it. What our own human nature is like, what we desire, what we want to see, what we want to listen to. So it's part of our journey and part of our evolution and part of the human experiment. And, you know, I've like I had said at the beginning of the this newsletter is that I'm immersed in a project right now that discusses all of this. It's really important to understand this, to write something like this. And would I say it's an anti-violent movie? In ways it is, you know, but I think to be purely anti-violent would be to completely eradicate it and dismiss it and punish people for it, whereas then it becomes hypocritical. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but I think what we should do is to examine why there are spikes in unnecessary violence, why there are spikes in these kind of brutal, violent crimes in history. What is it that's causing this? If someone were to ask me as a shorthand why the world at times has these horrible eruptions of violence during certain periods, I think it's that subconsciously a lot of people feel like there's poor leadership. And maybe the simplest example would be that in a lot of cases, some people in society are like children, bad children, and with bad tendencies. And when they know the substitute teacher is in the room, they're going to misbehave. I know a lot of people don't want to hear it that way, but I don't, you know, there are parts of society that I don't think very highly of because they're not making an effort to get their shit together. And and what I mean by that is anybody that chooses to, you know, cut some young lady's throat for a couple of bucks in her pocketbook and to think they're tough for doing it. Those are the biggest cowards on earth. You're a coward. The bravest people on earth are the ones that face the destruction of their own ego, that can deal with being humiliated and not have that steer them into either violence or into some kind of, boasting to prove themselves. The greatest people on earth are the ones that wait, watch, listen, and calculate their next move of not only what they're going to accomplish, but their own evolution of the mind, consciousness, body, spirit, all of the above. And so, to close my little rant for tonight, I think our greatest quest as people should be self-enlightenment. And self-enlightenment isn't sitting cross-legged, you know, in Sedona, praying to crystals. I think what it really is an understanding, a lack of naivete, and an open mind to all that is dark and light in the world. You cannot be afraid. I think even if you're a devout Christian, you should not be afraid to read the Satanic Bible to understand what this person wrote. You should not be afraid to read the Quran. You should read every page of it and fully understand every piece of literature that comes from your enemy. You should read it. Know your enemy. Know if that is your enemy. The only way to identify it is to understand in full detail. Don't take someone else's word for it. Don't take biased opinions for it. Open your own mind to your own experiences, to enlightenment and evolution. That is it until the day you cross over and go to some other place, till your body expires and your consciousness moves on. That is my own quest. And that is why I'm here even creating things. And that is why I spent the time tonight to say what I had to say for anyone that's listening. So I thank you so much for hearing my rant tonight. And I wish you all the greatest. I will be back next week with a really interesting conversation with a gentleman named Shane Bugby. You know, an artist, a provocateur. He's a kind of a historian on serial killers. And he has a history and even knew Anton LaVey personally. So what an interesting conversation. For any walk of life, come and listen to next week's episode, next Wednesday. Hear what Shane has to say. He's going to tell great stories about his life. He's lived such an interesting life so far. And this is how I approach every guest on Off to the Witch. I want to bring you people that have experienced things, that have something to say. Some of my episodes, a good deal of them, are regarding the world's mysteries and the paranormal because I'm interested in it. But we always approach it in a way where I want to hear from the guest. I want to hear their story. I don't want to put them on the hot seat. I want to hear about it from their perspective, and I want to hear details. But these things are decided beforehand, that I'm not just going to have any old Joe on the show that has a story about, you know, some encounter with whatever. There are too many people running that racket today. And I think it could be a detriment to continuously entertain any old story without asking proper questions, without challenging it somewhat, because you should. And so I'll leave you with this. I think we should always be in this place of enlightenment and evolution. And sometimes the medicine to achieve that goal can be quite harsh. And in the case of this thing that I'm writing right now, I'm learning that, you know. I knew I've had moments in my life where either this cinema was like, it was like a thrill because of the audacity of the filmmaker or the craft work of the movie maker. I just admire the work of artists. So that supersedes sometimes maybe how powerful it could be for someone else or how off-putting it could be because I'm looking at something different. And so I try to always re-examine things. And, you know, through my own work, I learn. And I hope when you see this motion picture and you see these new documentaries come from me, that it always comes from this extremely open-minded perspective that we're allowing new ideas in all the time and to absorb things and to learn and to also be entertained. So I wish you the greatest. I thank you for listening to me tonight. And I'll see you next week with a brand new guest, Shane Bugby. And come and say hello. Subscribe to the YouTube channel if you haven't. And there's so much up ahead. And I look forward to sharing it all with you. So have a wonderful night and take care.